it would limit or restrict the state's ability to adequately meet the needs of low-income families as far as supplemental nutrition goes.
The state braces for cuts to the federal food stamp program. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Arctic Ocean science expedition delivers a big surprise under the sea ice.
It was just green pea soup. It was the greenest waters I've ever seen, and it was completely unexpected.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans.
A wildfire in the northern interior is drawing a major response. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
A fire at the dump in the Kayakuk River community of Allakaket spread to surrounding forest late Wednesday. It had burned 2,000 acres by the morning. The wind-driven blaze prompted the Alaska Fire Service to throw a lot at it.
Fire retardant aircraft, water scooper aircraft, smoke jumpers, and a hotshot crew.
That's Fire Service spokesman Mel Slater. He says winds have been blowing away from the village, helping firefighters trying to protect the community.
They have been able to contain the perimeter about 2.25 miles from town.
Slater says conditions are very dry around Allakaket, and another crew and an incident management team are being brought in. It's unknown what started the fire at the dump. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The United States Senate passed a massive farm bill today. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, it cuts long sacrosanct direct payments to farmers, but by and large maintains billions of dollars for food stamps.
The farm bill has historically paid for a slew of programs, from crop subsidies to farmers, to federal agencies to promote trade, and to states to pay for the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. Most people call that last mouthful food stamps. The program came under attack in a number of amendments that ultimately failed, in part because of the price tag. Over the next decade, this plan authorizes more than $700 billion for food stamps.
80% of the ag bill is food stamps.
That's Alabama Republican Senator Jeff Sessions. He led the charge to reduce food stamp funding in the debate. In part, he says, because people are gaming the system.
For the last 2+ years, unemployment has dropped a little bit, but the number of food stamp recipients continues up.
He's right. Food stamp use is on the rise. It's at record levels. In Alaska, there are nearly 40,000 households who receive some kind of food aid, and it's been on an upward swing for some time. The state's caseload has increased 76% over the last 5 years. And yet, while there are record numbers of people in the country receiving food stamps, the Senate actually cuts funding for the program. But it could have been much worse. The final package cuts more than $4 billion over the next decade. Ron Creer is the director of public assistance for the state. He says any cut gives him pause.
It would limit or restrict the state's ability to adequately meet the needs of low-income families as far as supplemental nutrition goes.
And it's hard to predict what it ultimately means for Alaska because the legislative process is ongoing. Creer says when there's less federal money, states have either reduced the value of monthly checks or made it harder to qualify in the first place. It's not an easy choice to make.
You know, in a situation where a household is receiving a minimal allotment of $10 or so, how those households actually save up their allotment until they've actually got enough to make a meaningful purchase. So, you know, a reduction of just a couple of bucks for a household that's receiving a minimal allotment is going to be significant.
Senator Mark Begich voted for the measure, and he also supported a failed amendment that would have restored the food stamp funding.
You know, here's the problem. We have no money. It's not complicated. No money, somewhere you have to give some relief.
The relief he talks about is actually law. The federal government is working under tighter budgets, so this bill had to trim its value. And it does. The farm bill cuts about $23 billion over a decade. Senator Lisa Murkowski voted against the bill, but she was one of three Republicans to vote for the amendment which preserved food stamp funding. She says even though the bill has worthy reforms, it does not meet the right balance of cuts and spending.
I think that a very legitimate deduction should be in these subsidies that are directed to agriculture businesses, agribusinesses that are doing quite fine, thank you very much.
Perhaps the most striking element of the Farm Bill's passage is just how it happened, through the normal legislative process. A committee spent months crafting a bill and marking it up. Then Senate leaders allowed debate and votes on dozens of amendments, including more than a handful with no relation to agriculture whatsoever. Then it passed with bipartisan support. That's the way the Senate is designed to work, though it has not worked consistently like this in a while. The optimists in this town are hoping the momentum continues, but others are more skeptical. The House is crafting its own farm bill. And one plan there slashes food stamp money by $150 billion. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
A discovery of large blooms of plankton under sea ice off the coast of Alaska is forcing scientists to rethink their theories about the food web of the Arctic Ocean. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Last year, the icebreaker Healy went into the Chukchi Sea on a National Aeronautics and Space Administration mission known as IceScape. It found plankton under the ice in abundance. There's a connection between the space program and the ocean because plankton blooms, the base of the ocean's food chain, can be tracked from space by reading color differences in the water.
But you can't see if they're ice with a satellite, and so we've missed all this in the past. And typically ships don't go in, and it just doesn't get measured.
That's Kevin Arrigo, the Stanford University biological oceanographer who made the discovery with the icebreaker. Scientists have long known that plankton had some sort of ecosystem under the ice, but not on this scale. Ken Dunton at the University of Texas has tried to measure the life under the ice by actually diving under it in the winter.
It's actually a very, very important period, but yet it's a period of time that we just have not been able to spend a lot of work looking at.
It's not hard to imagine the expense that would be involved with this type of research. So the biologists try to make the most of any icebreaker time the physical oceanographers and subsea mappers let them have. That's why Kevin Arrigo left the fluorometer, the plankton-sensing device, on when they sent the Healy into the ice of the Chukchi Sea.
When we headed into the ice, we assumed that the numbers that this instrument was going to give us was they were going to start going down, just because whenever you go into the ice, they always go down. Well, they just kept climbing and climbing and climbing.
The Healy went more than 20 miles into the ice, and the measurements did not stop climbing.
When we got about halfway in, it was about 3 feet thick, and by the time we got all the way in, it was 4 feet thick. And that was the area where the concentrations were higher than anywhere else that we'd seen in the entire region. They were high all the way down to over 200 feet. And so it was just top to bottom. It was just green pea soup. It was the greenest waters I've ever seen, and it was completely unexpected.
So how can a phytoplankton, a plant that needs light to live, be thriving in the darkness under the ice?
As a phytoplankton person myself, I'm thinking this is impossible. How can these things be growing under so thick of sea ice? And so fortunately, we got out on the ice and made a bunch of measurements and sort of at least solved that mystery, and that is because there's been all these melt ponds on the surface. And so it turned out it wasn't nearly as dark under the ice as we had expected it would be because there were all these melt ponds.
Lying on top of the ice, the melt ponds make it transparent and the light comes through to the plankton. Lots and lots of plankton.
It turns out the amount of production, the amount of food being produced by these phytoplankton under the ice was 10 times higher than in the open water after that ice had retreated from that area.
This large food source in the Arctic could be a recent development brought on by climate warming. All the ice in that area now melts off every year and then refreezes, and it's much more likely to have melt ponds than ice from multiple years. Arrigo says satellites usually can't see the melt ponds because they don't have high enough resolution. So they are going to have to come up with other ways to find out whether it's just the Chukchi or other areas as well that have this extensive production. Biologists also don't know whether all this new food will lead to rich Arctic fisheries. Arrigo says much of the plankton probably ends up on the ocean floor, so bottom-feeding species could be favored. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a fishing trip on the Kuskokwim with subsistence fishermen protesting the closures.
I sat around long enough wondering when we'll get fish. Today's the day.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
Alaska wildlife troopers and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service seized 21 nets and more than 1,000 pounds of salmon along the Kuskokwim River yesterday. They also handed out 33 citations to fishermen protesting the subsistence king salmon closures. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes got out on the river and spoke with some residents as they fished.
It's a windy day on the Kuskokwim near the village of Nabuskiak, but it doesn't keep local Yupik fishermen from net fishing for king salmon.
Nice!
Teddy pulls a large king salmon over the side of his small aluminum boat. He doesn't want to give his last name because he's fishing illegally. The river has been closed to fishing with salmon nets for the past week.
I sat around long enough wondering when we'll get fish. Today's the day.
Teddy, like other Yupik men, has dozens to provide for. There are his five children, his sister's five children, community elders, and widows. And then there's families who can't fish because they lost a family member, and Yupik tradition requires a year of grieving with no river activities.
You know, we're the kind of people that prepare, you know, mostly for winter living. And summer's the only time we gather a whole lot while we can. Because this is ours, the whole thing is our store. Our Walmart, our supermarket. They close that, it's like not going to the store for a week.
Putting up fish for the winter isn't easy. There are many factors that are dependent on run timing and weather. What is certain, say subsistence fishers, is that it must happen at the right time.
If the fishes are passed, they won't come back and around here to Kuskokwim. I'm out of Kuskokwim around here.
Noah Akoviak lives in Nabuskiak, but is originally from another coastal village. He was fishing along the same riverbank as Teddy. Protest fishing was happening all along the Kuskokwim. Akoviak and elders in other villages encouraged their younger men to go fish for their families.
Because that's our life to eat the king salmon since I born. I didn't born for the white people foods, but not apple or candy or something like that.
Back in Teddy's boat, he brought in five kings and several more red or sockeye salmon after a few drifts.
Yeah. I think we got our limit for now. Can't put too much work on my lady.
Teddy's wife and other women in his family will be responsible for processing the salmon. They will decide which fish get eaten immediately, shared, or saved for drying. The dried fish must be cut up, hung on drying racks, and then moved to a smokehouse. With favorable weather and careful monitoring, it takes a few weeks. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
This year's Chinook salmon run on the Yukon is poor, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is preparing subsistence closures there to meet escapement goals. The closures begin today, but with so few fish in the river, it's unknown how long subsistence fishermen will be unable to fish. Steve Hayes is Fish and Game's summer season manager for the Yukon. He says the run is falling short.
Unless something changes, we either don't have enough fish to meet the escapement goals, or we'll barely meet the escapement goals, but that's going to take severe restrictions on the backs of the subsistence fishermen.
By mid-June, only 4,500 kings had passed the pilot station sonar site, about 120 miles from the mouth of the Yukon. Hayes says those numbers should be 10 times larger. To hit escapement targets and make sure enough king salmon make it upriver to spawning grounds in Canada, Fish and Game is closing subsistence fishing on the lower Yukon as the first pulse of king salmon move upriver. There will be 36-hour closures, one district at a time, amounting to about a five-day closure. Orville Huntington is the Wildlife and Parks Director for the Tanana Chiefs Conference, a tribal consortium of the 42 villages in interior Alaska. He's also a lifelong subsistence fisherman. He says most people were prepared for a bad year.
You know, we're just going to have to take and bite the bullet. There's a lot of us on the Yukon that are willing to not fish at all if we have to.
While subsistence fishermen hope for a strong chum run later in the season, Hayes says Fish and Game is prepared to implement more closures if necessary. The Wrangell Medical Center's board of directors fired the hospital CEO yesterday. That's despite the fact that nearly every board member was recalled in a special election earlier this week and due to leave office. The dispute over the hospital board and leadership has divided the community of Wrangell over the past year, and there is no indication the rift will heal anytime soon. KSTK's Charlotte Duren has been covering the mess and joins me now. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, Lori.
So, Charlotte, take us back over the last few days. What has happened in Wrangell?
On Tuesday, we had our special election for the recall of 8 of our 9 hospital board members. Unofficial results on Tuesday resulted in all 8 being recalled. Just today, we had our absentee counted, and it now is clear that the official results are that all 8 have been recalled. 2 days later, or no, the next day on Wednesday, we had our hospital board meeting, a regular board meeting. It was the board's potentially last meeting. And, you know, the meeting carried on as usual. And then right at the end of the meeting, after they came out of executive session, they motioned to fire hospital CEO Noel Salray, and they approved it and fired and terminated his employment at the Wrangell Medical Center.
And that CEO had a new contract in place. Tell us about that.
Yeah, just about a month ago, his contract was revised. It happened just after information that a recall was going on. His new contract upped his salary to $185,000 plus. It had some revisions that he would be paid that for 5 years on, that he couldn't be fired for anything he had done previous to March, and that if he were fired without cause, he would get a hefty severance package that totals over $1.2 million in both health and salary payout.
Is that legal?
Right now, that's unclear. His contract has not been approved by the city, and at this time, it's kind of unclear if that contract is legal, if the board's termination is legal, and if any of this will actually carry out. Right now, the city is talking to their lawyers, and right now everything's just trying to be figured out. The board is recalled, and the CEO is terminated. At this time, the hospital CFO, Alinda White, has taken over in his place, and I guess everything's just trying to be figured out at this time.
Charlotte, how much has this divided the community of Wrangell?
It's really divided the community. There's two sides. It's the hospital or it's the city or those who are indifferent. And, right now the community really is very polarized at this point, and it's going to take a lot to get it back to where it was.
Well, and this isn't a large community. Do you think the residents there can eventually move forward and heal from this?
You know, from what I've been told, there's been a lot of, contentious issues over the years, from, the timber issue, then to the Nolan Center, and now to this. I think eventually the community will move on. I think at this point, there's a lot that's unclear. Many community members just want to see a new board get in place and see some of these issues get resolved, see the USDA loan come through, and just kind of see the project move forward. It's, at this point, it really comes down to the community just wants a new hospital, we need one. A lot of communities, our long-term care at the hospital needs a lot of work, and we're just looking to get a new hospital. And, you know, if that takes a new board and a new CEO, then that's what the community is looking for.
All right. Well, thanks for the update, Charlotte.
Yeah, thank you.
Charlotte Duran is a reporter at KSTK in Wrangell.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has over 70 job openings available statewide in nursing, social work, and child protection. There's nothing more important than protecting the health and well-being of Alaska families, so take the first step towards a meaningful career. Visit dhss.alaska.gov and click on Careers. Join their team and make a difference every day. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Is Alaska ready for the space age? That's the question on the mind of some state senators who hosted the Alaska Rocket and Space Summit at the Anchorage Legislative Information Office today. The day-long session featured presentations from representatives of successful aerospace enterprises in Florida and Utah, and from Alaska agencies like the State Department of Transportation and the Alaska Aerospace Corporation. Alaska Senate President Gary Stevens says the state needs to decide the level it wants to fund the developing aerospace industry. He says Governor Parnell put $25 million into the budget this year to maintain the Alaska Aerospace Corporation, a state-owned agency which operates the Kodiak Launch Complex.
You know, we put a lot of money into that over the years. The federal government has put $140-some million. We put over, you know, probably about $50 million when all is said and done. They've had some $150 million in revenues from the launches they've already had. And now that we've done that, we need to make sure that it works.
Stephen says Lockheed Martin has also promised to put $100 million into a medium-sized lift facility at the Kodiak launch site this year. Lockheed Martin wants the Kodiak site for its Athena 3 rocket for West Coast launches. Stephen says the Athena is able to launch payloads of 13,000 pounds into orbit.
The advantage that Alaska has is in polar flights, you know, in launching satellites in the polar orbit, which is pretty interesting. We know the state has quite that ability. We are just ideally situated for that. And what is remarkable for me, having lived in Kodiak for some 40 years, is the weather conditions there are actually better than in some of the other sites, because you can launch, even though it may be cloudy or rainy, you can still launch.
Stephen says the testimony he's heard indicates that satellites can be launched from Alaska as effectively and as economically as anywhere else in the country. Insurance companies will have to help pay for autism treatments in Alaska under legislation that's now slated to become law. Governor Sean Parnell gave tacit approval to the measure this month by sending it back to the legislature without his signature. The new requirement only covers a portion of the insurance market for now. However, supporters see it as an important step in providing relief for parents who struggle with the high cost of autism therapy and counseling. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Petersburg parent Kari Peterson has insurance, but she says it doesn't cover her son's autism. Peterson says the disorder is defined by an individual's ability to relate and communicate with others. Her family pays out of pocket for counseling to help her son build those skills, but they can't afford some of the specialized therapy and evaluation services he needs.
One thing I've always really wanted to get for him that has been out of reach from the beginning is speech therapy services. And They're just so expensive, but it's something that he's needed from the very beginning but hasn't been able to get.
Senate Bill 74 requires that insurers cover behavior and speech therapy as well as other treatments for children with autism spectrum disorders. The bill passed the legislature this spring with bipartisan support. Governor Sean Parnell chose to send it back to the legislature without signing it, which means it will become law late this month. In a June 12th letter to the Senate, Parnell expressed support for the measure while acknowledging concerns opponents had raised about increased premium costs for businesses. The governor ultimately concluded that, quote, the long-term cost savings of discovering and intervening in autism spectrum disorder early in a person's life justify letting this legislation become law. Anchorage Democrats Johnny Ellis in the Senate and Pete Peterson in the House sponsored the legislation. Ellis calls it a godsend for the parents of autistic children in Alaska.
There are proven treatments, medical treatments for children that get people to a higher level of functioning who experience autism, and that's a great cost savings and great for Alaska families. So it's a big step forward for these families.
The bill includes an exemption for small businesses, which was a compromise sponsors made to get the measure passed. Also, according to Ellis, the legislature cannot mandate the coverage for some groups, including state workers or self-insured corporations. However, Ellis predicts the state will adopt the coverage for employees in its next bargaining cycle, as it has with past mandates like breast cancer or prostate screening.
We're setting the ball in motion. We're setting an example. We are legislating for the portion of the market that we can legislate, and if the past is any guide, and I believe it is, state employees will follow, and that will cover a lot of families, and then major insurers that are self-insured will follow suit as well to attract and retain the best employees to be competitive in the hiring market for good employees. So this is, it's an incremental process, but you have to do the right thing and start the ball rolling, and that's what we've done here today.
Opponents of the bill included the health insurance company Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. In comments to the legislature this spring, Senior Vice President Jack McCrae argued that some of the services covered in the law are the responsibility of school districts rather than insurers. McCrae wrote, quote, "The proposal would add to the overall cost of health care and would be borne by insured members," unquote. According to Media Relations Manager Amy Carter, Premera still has those concerns. However, in an email response to an interview request, Carter said the company was, quote, "working to implement this as smoothly as possible for our customers," unquote. Senate Bill 74 includes the creation of a legislative task force, which will draft a statewide plan for the early diagnosis and treatment of autism. The insurance requirement goes into effect for policies issued or renewed after January 1, 2013. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Matthew Smith in Nome, Charlotte Duran in Wrangell, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.